You see, kids, motorsport is a funny old game. You put 24 cars around a circuit, they go round and round lots of times, and in the end, Mercedes wins. Hi, everybody. I'm Andre Harrison. Welcome to episode 291 of Motorsport 101, as joined, as ever, by our esteemed co-host, Mr. RJ O'Connell. Hello, sir.
The amount of crypto propaganda that's been propagating all my timelines in the last few weeks is terrifying. I don't know what to think about it. I don't know why people are bidding hundreds of thousands of dollars for 10-second NBA clips that they turned into non-fungible tokens. I wasn't even aware that fungible was a word to describe something.
That is new to me. That is definitely new to me. I have seen little bits of this as well. It is terrifying, and it's not like my new favorite F1 team didn't just have a crypto partner announced yesterday. Dang it.
Would this be the green one?
It might be the green one. I was kind of hoping the merch would roll up today so I could say I'm totally not an Aston Martin shill, although the joke visually might be funnier in 2 weeks' time. We'll go with that. Creative decision to delay the shipment by a day. We'll go with that. It sounds way funnier in my head. with me as well is Ryan King, who's currently celebrating the fact that his Knicks are actually 500. Like, yeah. What the hell?
We were above 500 on Sunday when things changed.
You lost. Yeah. That's why a regression to the mean, although the Knicks currently being, what, a 5 seed is a terrifying thought for us all in the world of basketball. They all count, as they say, even if half the conference will end up getting in under 500, because the East sucks. Fun times for all involved. But, yeah, Cam, how you doing over there?
Fantastic, now that Kemba Walker is slowly but surely remembering how to play the game of basketball.
It helps.
Yeah, the Celtics dipped right to 500, and thankfully are coming back. Never in my wildest nightmares would I figure that this season would be the season where the Celtics and the Knicks cross over in terms of competitive ability. And overall, makes me want to puke, like a cat.
Yeah.
Thank you for tuning into our basketball podcast.
I know, right?
Yeah, basketball, motorsports, existential dread at the fact that Mercedes is once again putting in the hours to whoop some ass.
Indeed. It is a terrifying thought, which we will address in the second half of the podcast, because we've got some, you've probably seen by now, some very sad news coming out of the MotoGP paddock, which we'll get to very shortly, but also catching up on some big news in the sports car world, because a certain big name manufacturer, one that likes a horse, as its badge, is on the way back, and we'll break some of that down as well, and break down some of the little minor news stories to come from the end of February/early March, and then we'll get into quite a roller coaster Formula E opening weekend in Riyadh, and there's a lot to break down from that, where two guys a car getting flipped upside down and ended up going into a wall wasn't the biggest story in terms of a world news standpoint that happened this past weekend. We'll get into all of that in the next 45 minutes or so. But places you can find us real quick are on youtube.com/motorsport101. If you're watching us on YouTube, hi, you can subscribe down below. Hit the bell for notifications on all our new videos, contents, hangouts, and all of that fun stuff. If you're listening to us on audio, you can subscribe over there. If you haven't already, where all good podcasts are available, we're on facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter at motorsport_101. Our personal handles are on the screen right now down below. But if you're listening to us on audio, they're at Harrison101HD, at RJ O'Connell, at Ryan Eric King, and at C Buckley 917. We're on Instagram at Motorsport101Pod. You can check us out on there as well. And if you're really, really lucky, so you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. And I just want to say a big shout out as well to not only Josette for repledging, and also our new friend Colonel Nuts that's backed us personally. You can follow him on Twitter. Yes, he really is a squirrel, and yes, we now have to stand the squirrel because they are very generous with their nuts.
Didn't Rick and Morty teach you nothing? Don't fuck with squirrels.
No, never. Of course not. So thanks to those guys for pledging that. It's the highest amount of Patreon backers we've ever had on the show, which, given the current difficult times, to say the least, around the world, is quite the miracle. So thank you all very much for that, for your continued support. Much, much appreciated. As I said, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all our audio shows. $10 gets you into the supporters club of ours. Also, in the supporters section, there's now a quote section, and I've just been put in there, so I had to pause just a second there. Whoops, my bad. But the supporters club of our Discord server, you can listen to these shows live as they go out. We've got a bunch of friends and all that as well. We've got Zale in here. We've got we've got Rezzy. We've got Finley, Jason, Sasha, Vic, and we have Lewis Sotheby, our old friend in the show as well, and big congratulations to him. We're going to be seeing him on MotoGP's online coverage, given he put it out there on Twitter, so it's okay for me to say here now. Congrats, Lewis. We love you, man. Keep fighting the good fight, buddy.
Huge congratulations to Lewis. You deserve it.
Yeah, do not shit your bricks. You're going to ace it, my friend. we're not jealous at all over here.
Not
get in
all.
There, son. brilliant work, my man. Brilliant work. We can't wait to see you on there. Without further ado, after this quick musical break, we'll be back to talk about the news. The motor racing world lost Fausto Gresini on February 23rd. He had battled through the novel coronavirus since the end of December, and his condition began to worsen due to a lung infection that ultimately claimed his life. Most know Fausto Gresini as the founder of the Gresini Racing Team, who currently operates Aprilia's MotoGP factory team. But prior to his life as a team executive, Gresini was a champion rider in the 125cc class. In 1984, he claimed his first Grand Prix victory. The next year, he claimed his first world championship. Gresini's peak as a rider came in the 1987 season. In 11 races, Gresini won 10 of them, only falling short of a perfect season in the very last race. After a 12-year riding career that yielded 21 victories, 17 pole positions and 43 podiums over 132 starts, Gresini would soon begin the next chapter of his motorcycle racing legacy. It took a while for Gresini Racing to find their footing in the sport, but their peak in the MotoGP World Championship would arrive in the mid-2000s. Sete Gibernau rose from journeyman to championship contender aboard Gresini's Telefonica Movie Star Hondas, claiming back-to-back runner-up spots in 2003 and 2004. The dazzling Marco Melandri would continue their winning ways in 05 and 06. In that time, Gresini Racing were the strongest independent team in the paddock. Gresini never saw his team win a world championship in the Premier category, but won four across all classes of competition. The Giro Cato dominated the 250cc class in 2001. Unlikely underdog winner Tony Elias was the first Moto2 champion in 2010. Jorge Martin became a Moto3 world champion in 2018, the foundation of what could turn out to be an exceptional career. Gresini's team even made history when Matteo Ferrari became the first ever Moto E World Cup winner in 2019. Gresini and his team had to overcome not one but two unthinkable tragedies in the modern era. Kato, the most sensational Japanese rider to emerge of a generation, would perish days after a crash in his home round in Suzuka in 2003. Marco Simoncelli, the brazen and charismatic Italian rider, was on the cusp of a MotoGP breakthrough in his second season, but Simoncelli would also lose his life in a race at Sepang in 2011. Heartbroken and on the verge of leaving the sport in grief, Gresini and his team pressed forward, continuing their racing activities, and in 2015 becoming a factory squad for the very first time. Motorsport 101 would like to extend our condolences to the Gresini family and to everyone who's been impacted by him during his life. Now, I want to give full credit to RJ for writing that. I just made it sound fancy, but he summed it up better than I ever could. And a very, very important figure in motorcycle racing, in independent bike racing. And I mean, look, if you celebrate just how incredibly competitive MotoGP is now, and seeing the fact that, you know, in the last 5 years, independents have gotten to the point where they can now challenge for titles, challenge for race wins, and be competitive. The heartbeat of that came from Gresini, because we saw him do that with people like Sete Gibernau now 15 years ago, and that's something that it's hard to fathom when we had a block of it just being orange and blue at the top for years and years and years. And yeah, to have Gresini be that thorn in the side, that guy that could go out and build a phenomenal racing team and take many a great rider to victories, was very, very impressive indeed. And like I said, one of the real beating hearts of a very tight-knit paddock in GP races. It's very much they like were, a family.
they were the privateer soul of the grid for many a year. And Fausto Grassini was an integral part of this. You know, we know how competitive MotoGP is. But the paddock is a family all the way through. And it's strange not having him here now.
It's extremely strange, and it's also a heartbreaking reminder of the times we live in right now. I mean, you don't think about COVID-19 so much day to day until it affects someone that you recognize or someone you know. And
it's not just a minor inconvenience. This is real.
Yeah.
And irrespective of age, of position in the world, the resources you may have, it could take you. It could take someone who you care very deeply about. And we are by no means out of the woods yet.
Indeed. You know, your level of optimism may vary, but this is still a very real thing. It's, let's not forget, Grassini was 60. You know, this has had a disproportionate effect on the older community. And yeah, it's a heartbreaking reminder of just how difficult it can be in the midst of a pandemic. And it's just a crippling, crippling blow. Like I said, one of the real heart and soul members of the paddock, and has been for over 30 years of his life. And you know, the team will soldier on. They've got some fantastic talent underneath them still, and I'm sure they'll be racing with very heavy hearts, but the name will carry on, and I'm sure it will carry on in great style and at the front of the field where they belong, like Fausto did, leading the charge for many a decade. So one more time,
as mentioned in a very accomplished rider in his own right. 21 Grand Prix victories, 17 pole positions in relatively few starts, 132. Yeah,
it's not a lot.
That's a damn solid career.
Indeed. Rest in power, Fausto, and from all of us here and to all those affected by his loss, we wish him the very best. And awful news.
I also wanted to mention, I know I didn't put it in the set list, but we also lost World Rally Champion Hannu Mikkola on the 26th. He passed away of cancer at the age of 78. 18 WRC victories spanning 1974 to 1987, and of course the 1983 World Rally Champion driving for Audi in the legendary Quattro A1 and A2. It's been a sad week when we've lost two very important people in the sports.
Two legends of their respective eras.
I agree, yeah.
Indeed. Awful weekend, but as motorsport finds a way, we race on. And now, just so you know, news wise we are saving the F1 car launches for our season preview in a couple of weeks time, so if we don't mention your favorite team's new livery, there's good reason for that. Check back in a couple of weeks time. But in the interim, we did get a very, very big piece of news coming out of Ferrari. Now, there was always talk that they might move some resources over to other series in the wake of F1's cost cap that's now effective, and that's coming into the sport now. And this one, I think, caught a lot of people by surprise. They are the latest manufacturer to commit.
I don't know about that. It's that we kept hearing about it, and we kept not believing it, because, well, they haven't been here in a factory setting since 1973.
Right. So,
but Ferrari, the Scuderia themselves in a factory program, are coming back to Le Mans in the top class, entering a Le Mans hypercar for 2023.
It's not just a F1 quit threat to try and get more leverage. They're actually doing it.
Right. Because for them, this is a better way than letting people go. At the end of the day, they said this themselves. I mean, they were flirting with the possibility of maybe an IndyCar supplier for power units, given their new hybrid era coming soon. But this is massive. I mean, it's yet another exciting name to add to the list of hypercar entries. It's something that
Brings it up to we already have had Toyota, Peugeot, Alpine entering a grandfathered LMP1 and potentially building a hypercar for the new regulations. And Redacted, who we'll get to in a few minutes, because I don't know. They blocked me on Twitter. I don't know if I'm allowed to say his name anymore.
They blocked a lot of people on Twitter.
They blocked a lot of people. They said a lot of mean things. We'll talk to them a little later. But this is exciting. As I said, Ferrari has not entered a factory program in the top class at Le Mans since 1973, where they finished runner-up. They've been gone for a very long time, but we forget Ferrari were once, by a country mile, the most dominant company at Le Mans. I believe 9 overall victories, their last coming in 1965, before obviously Ford's battle with them, Porsche's battle with them, and then Matra, when they left at the end of 73 to focus on their Formula One efforts.
And like one of the things that I think I talked about on the show before that I was happy about seeing a cost cap in Formula One is that it would force these big factory outfits to either downsize or use those resources elsewhere. Especially, you know, with motorsport right now where it's hard for people to find seats. Well, drivers to find seats. It creates opportunities for more people to go racing.
Absolutely. Mm. This is going to be a godsend for Ferrari or Ferrari adjacent drivers who may not have a long lifespan in F1, who may be academy drivers that might find themselves roadblocked on a road to F1, maybe former Ferrari guys who always had that level of talent but could just never break through. I think that would be very, very good for them. And of course, now they're already angling to try and get Charles Leclerc to run Le Mans.
Charles has openly said that he likes the idea. Yeah. And I think, first of all, it's just Ferrari entering a factory program in a top level mode. That's just cool.
Yeah.
Right? They're a huge name. Back it up with enormous budget and development talent behind them. Not that you'd tell from last year's season in F1.
Mm.
But yeah. And it bolsters an already strong grid.
Mm.
And it gives the opportunity for drivers in F1 to potentially branch out into other forms of motorsport like they did in days gone past.
Yeah, look, anything that provides an alternate path on that road is ultimately a good thing as far as I'm concerned. We are a driver-focused sport in terms of personalities and emotional investments. I'm glad more than ever more and more drivers are realizing that there is more to life than Formula One, and you know, they can be viable big names in other series. And like I've spoken to many American journalists about how IndyCar feels like an all-star game this year for a series, given the mix of talent coming in from NASCAR, from F1, from supercars over across the pond. You know, it's fascinating to see how they're all going to mesh and intertwine. And the same extends to sports cars. I mean, it's hard not to be excited about half a dozen, you know, factory manufacturers coming back to race at Le Mans again in the top flight. And let's be honest, Ferrari is on another level. It's Ferrari. They are the sexy brand. You know, it's like you can talk about Porsche and Toyota and all that, but Ferrari will always raise people's eyebrows more than most.
Now we're going to have the three winningest brands in Le Mans history being Porsche, Audi, and Ferrari all competing on the same track together.
Just fun think, time. In 2023, we'll all have our COVID vaccines, our Fauci ouchies, if you will. racing circuits, including Circuito Sarth, will be at least partially open. And some of us that can afford to travel to Le Mans to see Porsche, Ferrari, and Audi compete against one another for the same overall honors in similar specs of cars, they're going to witness something special. I just hope that those times will come. Of course, one manufacturer that won't be taking part in that is Mazda. We learned this a couple weeks ago that Mazda's not pursuing any prototype activities beyond the end of this season, which is
felt like the writing was on the wall when they downsized to one car.
I wanted to see the LM55 VGT come to Hypercar. Dang it.
No. No, that car is cursed.
That car is cursed.
Mazda have always been just sort of there in IMSA, hamstrung by their partner team for quite a long time with Speed Source, who did not handle the transition from GT to prototype well at all. And even as they comprehensively rebuilt this program, redesigned their car, aligned themselves with Multimatic, and have a wealth of talent behind the wheel, they, other than maybe a couple wins a year, they've never been able to really break through. And when you learn about what happened this year at Daytona, where they almost had to keep the car turned down for 20 of the 24 hours, they had multiple bodywork failures, it just feels like this program was always on borrowed time.
It's a shame. They have beautiful cars. They have a wealth of really good drivers. But Mazda's going to keep their focus to more grassroots level racing, MX-5 Cups, which, for those who watched it at Daytona, were just the best pound-for-pound entertainment that was there. Junior Formula Racing in the States, I think. It's mostly just going to be like smaller scale events, which is typically what they've been good at. But no prototype programs. It's a shame, but such is the way that sports car racing is. It's also, you know, sports car racing is also filled with people with big ambitions and overinflated egos that maybe just need a reality check. And I'm not trying to segue into anything in particular, am I?
Oh, man.
So I want to start with a disclaimer. The opinions expressed on this show by myself or any of my friends, my co-host, are not necessarily those of any publications that I so happen to contribute to.
Gotcha. Anyway.
Scuderia Cameron Glickenhaus needs to log off.
Yep. We're talking.
They need to find a different social media manager.
Yeah, they need to find a social media manager.
I was going to say, it's not that their social media manager is saying this, it's that Jim is saying this. We've heard plenty from the last couple of last few months about how LMDHs are just store-bought and branded LMP2s with barely any effort put in by the manufacturers, who just drop their engine in, stick a couple branding bits on the car, and go racing. And that is an insult to the purity and sanctity of sports car racing as a whole. Well, King.
Yes.
Would you tell our wonderful audience who builds Scuderia Cameron Glickenhaus's 007 Le Mans hypercar?
Because
it's not Glickenhaus.
Yeah, it's not Glickenhaus. A very small engineering firm in the northwest of Italy called Podium Advanced Technologies, or they like to call themselves Podium Tech. They on their website, admit to completely designing and building Scuderia Cameron Glickenhaus's entry in Le Mans Hypercar, and also every Glickenhaus race car ever put in a competition.
Amazing.
So, would you say that him claiming that an outsourced racing car is impure is throwing some mighty big stones from a glass house?
Yes, it is absurdly hypocritical.
Yeah. It's a boulder in that glass house. It's a big boulder.
Look, I spoke about this at length in the Molson's Corner Facebook group. Is a crew of wonderful people who are very passionate about sports car racing, both historic and current. I just want prototype racing to be healthy.
Nope.
I wanted to have manufacturer entries. I wanted to have privateer entries. I want it to be competitive. I wanted to have plenty of races. I want it to be sustainable. And LMDH's formula, alongside Le Mans Hypercar formula, are very integral to that.
Right.
It's a very important few years coming up for sports car racing of what do we want it to be? What can it be? Where is the line between going a little bit too far and overextending ourselves? And if manufacturers decide that LMDH, by purchasing one of four manufactured tubs from Multimatic, Ligier, Orica, and Dallara, buying a gearbox and buying your Curzon, and then doing the rest of the car, if that's a valid way to put a car together, who are we to really complain?
Yeah.
And this, like, the constant... Go ahead, King.
Everything that Jim Glickenhaus is complaining about is completely within the rules. And it is not good for the sport when a competitor within the sport is complaining about how someone else is competing. And his complaints have no well-being within the legality of those entries. They're, like, all his complaints... have no standing.
He speaks of it as the very regulations themselves are the problem.
Yeah. Mm.
That they shouldn't be allowed because they make it too easy. To which I counter, did anyone complain when Acura entered LMP2 with their own bodywork, suspension, and engine on a Courage LC75?
I didn't even know it was a Courage LC75, to be honest.
It was. In
which,
fact,
which just shows how little I care. Look, it's not inherently wrong that some D movie filmmaker has enough money to amass a car collection and then wants to go build or at least have someone help build him top class prototype cars. It's not inherently wrong that a privateer wants to go race against manufacturers in the new Le Mans LMDH hypercar.
Yeah. Biggest issue with Jim's comments is that what he wants effectively is to cleave the prototype field by two thirds.
Yeah, he does not want. He speaks as though LMHs will have such an advantage over LMDH that the only way for an LMDH to compete is to hold the hypercars back so badly that they don't get to run at their potential. While he's also preaching about his own car, talking about how the front aero in his car was inspired by cars from the 60s. And when you look at his car and the design concepts chosen, you realize... he's building a car to a target and hoping that BOP will bring him up to Toyota. Toyota designed an LMP1 car with extra steps. Glickenhaus designed, or outsourced their design, of a supercar built up into a Le Mans car.
I wouldn't even say it's a supercar. It is, by all means, a movie stunt car built for a racetrack.
Yeah, I was trying to be nice, but I mean, the man blocked me on Twitter when I pointed that out. So maybe subtleties had its day.
Look, I'm trying to find as many positive things about this project because look, they have Yost Racing helping to run the team, which honestly,
they have a fantastic set of drivers.
Yeah,
their engine supplier built them an engine more or less out of two Hyundai WRC engines. Not a bad engine to take as a base. There's the good aspects of it, and there's the fact that, you know, we want to see privateers take it to manufacturers. But we don't want our privateers being whiny blowhards on Twitter talking about how they're the only ones respecting the sanctity of sports car racing. Guess what? A Jaguar with a roof cut off and a Porsche engine slapped in the back won two Le Mans in a row in the 90s.
Yeah.
Right.
No one cares what's underneath.
Right, I was going to say, like, why is he being, like, I'm not the biggest sports car guy in the world. This has been an education to me the last week and a half, just seeing all of this in context and seeing it broken down. Like, am I getting the impression that there's no need for him to be so sanctimonious about this? Because it's just,
no,
like...
absolutely not.
No, like, it's like he wants an additional medal for picking the harder path.
Doing it the right way.
There's no medal for taking the harder path. Just ask all of the teams in the 1980s who tried to build a car that wasn't the Porsche 962 in IMSA showed up and got their ass beat.
Hell, look at Nissan's GTR Nismo factory. Yes, that was a radical departure from the norm. It only ran one race and didn't run run well. And I would hope that SGC can clear this bar. But I don't know. I mean, I want to like this project, but Jim's just got to log off. Get some therapy or something. It seems like this not, man would do anything not, but go to therapy.
Yeah, not enter the comment sections of articles written by friends of the show and write multi-stage essays tearing apart their entire career. He just comes off like a thin-skinned jackass. And while I was initially excited about his program, there is no need for someone to be involved with the sport to be this toxic and spray this much bile over nothing.
I'll root for the drivers.
He's making something out of nothing.
I'll root for the drivers. I think Jim acts too much like, well, like a 45th president in the United States, if I'm being completely honest.
Mm. Oh, he didn't have to do him like that, but I can't entirely disagree.
No.
In the last little bit of sports car news, yesterday was announced the number 48 Ally Cadillac of Jimmy Johnson, Simon Pagenaud, and Kamui Kobayashi, a fan favorite from this year's Daytona 24 Hours, will contest this entire Michelin North American Endurance Cup.
Yep, all the endurance.
Nice.
Yep. Look, more Kamui Kobayashi in an IMSA prototype. The world is a better place.
Box office.
More Jimmy Johnson.
Loved it.
More Simon P, my boy.
It's box office. Although people are, I guess NASCAR Twitter is like really mad that Jimmy Johnson's going away from the bootcut pants.
Yeah, I did see that.
NASCAR was
drivers.
Real mad about this. Like
it was Kyle Busch was angry on Maine over this.
Kyle Busch is always angry on Maine over everything, like this included.
Well, oh, I'll just have everyone know I'm team cuff pants.
Oh, are you? Is that something you wanted to admit to the world on a Discord server while recording a podcast game?
Team stirrup socks and baseball.
Oh, no. Team only podcasting football shirts. That's the only hill I will die on here. That's all I've got. RJ, we got some more motorsports to quickly run through here?
We did have some winners in NASCAR. Christopher Bell won the Daytona Road Course race, and William Byron won at Homestead, Miami. I understand Cam was not happy about the events of the Daytona Road Course race. Not necessarily Christopher Bell won, because that's cool that Christopher Bell won, but Chase Elliott had this race under lock and key, and the NASCAR made up a rule to kind of put him at the back of the field.
Yeah, NASCAR, this was actually a rain-affected race, and NASCAR does have wipers and rain lights and rain tires for road course events. Obviously, you can't make rain tires for an oval because...
Please do not at us with, why doesn't NASCAR race at an oval? Because spray is a thing.
Oh, my God. And it started raining. It was raining enough for teams to think about a tire change initially, but that rain quickly burned off. And then NASCAR decided, for some inexplicable reason, to throw a caution. We learned that there was a rule in place where, in the event of a weather change, NASCAR will throw a caution to give their teams a chance to change onto wet weather tires. Only for none of the teams involved in this race to put on wet weather tires, effectively only making this a competition caution to bunch the field back up.
I was watching this live, and for those who have been following this show for a while, I am not a NASCAR person. Everyone in here knows that I'm not a NASCAR person. I thought I'd make a special effort to watch this Daytona Road Course race. I saw that, and I immediately started slamming my face against my own desk, because I'm like, wait, what do you mean that, let's make me explain in this, right? Strategical changes while green flag racing is interesting. because you have that conscious decision on your mind as to whether to change for wet tires or not, and the sacrifices that come with that. That's interesting. Taking the interesting element away by putting a caution flag out kills the excitement, no matter which way
but Dre,
you slice
but Dre,
it.
You have to remember, NASCAR actively attempts to kill all strategic ability out of all of these races. It's the reason why stages exist, yeah, to more or less kill fuel mileage races.
They want the race to be decided wheel to wheel.
Wheel to wheel,
only,
hardcore,
only for,
bumper rubbing
only for
to the
strategic
line.
Decisions and tire changes to cost the driver who was by and large the best driver on the day, Chase Elliott, I'm not going to say surefire win because Christopher Bell was shadowing him, but those two were miles ahead of the field.
Yeah.
It just feels like another, either a rule they made up on the fly or an arbitrary rule that only exists to dumb the sport down.
Yeah. And look, no sport should be dumbed down to that level. Like it was actually a fascinating moment in that race that could have potentially led to some interesting strategies. Obviously, that's not how it would have played out anyway, but the fact that you were denied of the chance, I think, is just silly beyond all reasons. There's much more intrigue in a race than necessarily, you know, just having a big finish at the end. Something we'll probably talk about a bit more in about 10 minutes' time when we talk about Formula E. Because a lot of that also boiled down to intrigue. But more on that briefly. Yeah. Also,
quickly run these out. Oi Tanak won the Arctic Rally. Sebastian Ogier had two monumental crashes.
Santa Claus gave out the trophies.
Santa Claus, clearly a big rally racing fan.
I love that they had signature graphics to say Santa Claus was handing out the winner's trophy, and they said, yeah, residents of the land. And I'm just like, yeah. they just knocked on their door and thought, hey, Sam, do you want to, you know, I know it's quite a long off season for you. Do you mind handing out some rally trophies? And he was like, yeah, sure, why not?
Getting big Niki Lauda elderly fan vibes.
Right.
Yeah, and in between crashes, Sebastian Ogier casually 13.2 seconds up at one of the stages. Someone to tell him he's an old man retiring at the end of this year. I don't think he's realized. No. And Shane Van Gisbergen swept the Mount Panorama 500
at Bathurst.
The
placeholder event for the Adelaide 500s that we're not going to have for a while, if at all, or the Bathurst 12 Hours that we're not having this year. Two races, Van Gisbergen won them both. It's all new era without Scotty McLaughlin around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other people are winning.
Of course. I mean, if you need to replace a track, Bathurst ain't a bad replacement, is it?
No.
Could be worse.
I think we should race at Bathurst more often. I don't even care that it makes the events that we already have less special. I just want to see more Bathurst.
I think every event at Bathurst is incredibly special.
Yo, if NASCAR really wants net season to be the
no,
best season ever, part
no,
of
season,
stop,
no,
do not stop finish that sentence.
I don't even need to finish that sentence. I've already put the thought in your head, and that's what counts. And that's most of the
RJ. And now a cartoon anvil falls on RJ.
Formula One and MotoGP previews. At least Formula One previews are coming in 2 weeks' time. So we'll talk about all the car launches there. That should be a fun time for most of us. Most.
Oh, dear. I'll just take a big swig of what I think is water, but who knows what's actually in the bottle. Could be a lot of things. Anyway, for legal reasons, we cannot say this is alcohol. in the meantime, while we confiscate RJ's bottle, we'll be back to talk about Formula E in Saudi Arabia for its season opener.
How do you even talk about a strange weekend like this? The Formula E World Championship returned to the floodlit streets of Diriyah in Saudi Arabia this past weekend, kicking off the 2021 season. It was impossible to overlook the form of sophomore sensation Nyck de Vries in race one on Friday. De Vries was sensational, leading every practice session, both phases of qualifying, and then scoring his maiden victory in commanding fashion. It was also impossible to ignore the sensational double overtake by Venturi's Eduardo Martara, threading the needle between Pascal Wehrlein and Mitch Evans 20 minutes into the race. Oh, that was so good. Of course, while Martara and Evans rounded off the podium behind De Vries, three drivers were left to wonder what could have been for the day. Tom Blomqvist, Nico Müller, and rookie Nick Cassidy, who were all demoted from the Super Pole session at a guaranteed top six starting spot to the back of their grid when their times were disallowed for overspeeding in a yellow flag zone with less than a minute to go in the session. And then we get to Saturday, race two. Martara, the man who made the move of the race on Friday, couldn't even take the start when his Venturi couldn't slow down and crashed in final practice due to a brake failure. He had to go to the hospital, was released that same night, but unfortunately couldn't take the start. And we were also worried that his Venturi teammate Norbert Nato and both Mercedes cars couldn't take the start due to potential of the same mechanical failure happening. And then to close out race two, we were all very, very worried about Mahindra driver Alexander Lynn, who, when his car launched off the back of Mitch Evans, landed upside down and skidded at unabated speed into the Tech Pro barriers, where shortly thereafter he was taken to hospital. Lynn, thankfully, was not seriously hurt after the incident that ultimately stopped the race with minutes remaining, while many people were left to worry what happened, as the incident was never caught on television cameras and was only released days after. Sam Bird, in just his second race with Jaguar, wrestled the lead away from his former teammate in Pulsar to Robin Frins, extending his streak of seven consecutive winning seasons, while reigning champion Antonio Felix da Costa finished third behind Frins, but not before another collision with his teammate Jean-Eric Verne as the two DS Ticino drivers battled for position. And just to close out this weird weekend of electric racing, just as the fireworks were going off above the circuit of race two on Saturday, a drone carrying improvised explosives that may have been aimed at the circuit was intercepted. And penalties! Lots of penalties for drivers not taking attack mode in a race that was neutralized with 10 minutes left.
I believe there was 8 post-race penalties after race 2.
For various infractions.
Various infractions, the way it all jumbled out. Nick De Vries, who started from the back of the grid, ended up scoring points in the end because of that many demotions, move arounds, and time penalties. We'll
say Pascal Wehrlein had a drive-through penalty and started from the back, also scored points. This was a mess.
It was. This whole weekend was a relative mess. I mean, it all started out so smooth. Nick De Vries completely dominated Friday.
We thought we were going to get the textbook usual situation from F1 of Mercedes just breaking out the belt.
But then, then a Mercedes powertrain decided, what if brakes don't work?
Yeah, it was the failure of a fail-safe that I believe if the front brakes fail, it will shift all of the braking force to the rear to try and slow the car down. This failsafe did not work. As it turns out, it was a underlying problem on all 4 Mercedes powertrain cars. Mercedes corrected it with a software fix, but
they
obviously,
they
patched it, but they were not allowed to take part in qualifying for race 2.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it was kind of freaky to watch in real time, because it literally happened about 3 minutes before the whole practice stream, which was on BBC Sport in the UK, had to run it off the air real quick. So all we saw pretty much was Mortara go straight into the wall at quite a large amount of speed.
Yeah, and there was a stuck throttle for a short time.
Yeah, it looked like it. He'd gone straight into the wall. They had to quickly get off the air because they were running out of time on the practice broadcast. And we were asking questions on Twitter as to, is Mortara okay? Because obviously they didn't have time to give us an update because they had to get off real quick. And again, it was about half an hour later we found out, he's on the way to hospital via ambulance, but only for precautionary checks. Thankfully, he was okay. Dinged up, but nothing serious, thankfully. Cam got it in one. Software issue. Failsafe didn't work. Car in wall. Ouch. Basically. And as a result of that, all 4 Mercs cars had to start from the back. Which wasn't ideal, especially given Nick was so dominant the first day. I think that was the first time ever in Formula E that if it was a conventional weekend that a guy has led every single session. I think that's what I heard.
Yep, that was
Jack
the first time that's ever happened. And yeah, De Vries was sensational in race 1. An initial breakaway of him Pascal Wehrlein for Porsche on debut and Rene Rast on full-time debut for Audi. Truly the new guard, if you count Formula E being new for the three German makes. The three new boys just driving away
from everyone. The fact that this is going to be Rene Rast's only Formula E season.
Yeah.
As you do.
Making a count. Sam Bird. 100% winning record across his seasons. He's won a race in all of them.
My man was like, Sam Bird is so popular at this point. My man ran down the entire pit lane, high-fiving people as he went. One, probably not knowing what had happened further on down the track that caused the red flag in the first place, but also just high-fiving everybody because everyone likes Sam Bird. Also, I had to mention this earlier from race one. I'll be shocked if something beats Mortara for the Scotty Award this year because that was ridiculous.
That was ballsy. Oh.
Beautiful.
For me, that it's between that and Kamui Kobayashi just dunking Scott Dixon through the floor into the bus stop at Daytona. We've got a good class started, already.
Yeah, we're not even into F1 or MotoGP or IndyCar seasons, and we already have a potential slam dunk Scotty Award nominee.
Yeah,
yeah. Ridiculous. God, I love motorsport. and also. Not a whole lot of other big stories from race one. It was a relatively normal race.
Can I chip in a story from the weekend in general?
Sure. Yes.
It's good that Neo 333 are competitive again.
Oh, God. Okay. We need to.
There's a big caveat.
We need to discuss this for both of the typical backmarker teams. In race two, Dragon and Neo were actively fighting for the podium.
Wild.
Teams that did not score last year.
Yeah, and you need to take into account that five cars couldn't participate and qualify.
Yeah,
and
like all
as
four
we learned
Mercedes
as well.
Cars.
Yeah, all four Mercedes.
Group one is a death sentence.
Yeah, all four Mercedes plus Andre Lotterer.
Andre Lotterer.
Yeah, Lotterer who crashed in practice. And what we learned this weekend is Group 1 in qualifying is a death sentence at a track like this. If you're in Group 1, you line up in the back half of the field. Race 2, we need to talk about that final incident. Whew. Alex Lynn had an airplane crash.
Yeah, we need to break down exactly what happened for us to get to this point.
Yeah.
Because it was three separate incidents happening in very quick succession.
This was just the loudest one and the scariest one, because, I mean, we didn't know what was going on. For a hot second, we were, like, worried, that, like, oh, geez, is he all right? And we were right to do so, because they went off the air without showing us what the heck had happened.
Right. Well, and then we saw a clip appear on Twitter of trackside footage where we saw, initially there was a crash where Sebastian Buemi got into the wall, looks like on his own.
Yeah.
On the other part of the track, I believe it was Blomqvist and one of the BMWs.
Gunther.
Might have been Gunther, crashed going into that corner. This triggered a yellow flag.
And then pretty much as soon as the yellow flag was triggered, there was the last incident, the one that everyone is talking about.
Yeah, right, where that trackside footage showed that yellow flag happened, a pause of about 3 seconds, and then Alex Lynn careening down the track on his lid into a very hard collision rear first with the barrier.
If anyone's ever seen Valencia 2010 in Formula 1 and Mark Webber's terrifying flip off the back of, I think it was Heikki Kovalainen's Lotus.
Yes.
In 2010, this was very similar in real time.
It was more or less a copy-paste. It appeared that the car ahead of him, I believe it was Mitch Evans, slowed down for the yellow flag, tried to get out of the way, and as he jinked right, Lynn jinked right as well.
It was a bad weekend for Lynn in general, because remember, in race one, him and Sam Bird got together. Sam Bird was not too pleased with Alex Lynn about that.
Yep.
Lynn completely boxed
him in. Oh, geez, how could they possibly get any worse? And here's Alex Lynn having easily the most terrifying accident I've seen in a Formula E race since The very first race in the time Nick Heidfeld's car turned into a ballistic missile.
Yeah, and I mean, I noticed that when they initially showed the replay, or not the replay, the shot of the Blomqvist Gunther crash, you can just see out of the shot at the end of the track, you can see the bottom of Lynn's car planted in the barrier. And he hit the wall hard enough that it folded the rear crash structure under the car.
Yeah.
Jeez. For everybody Massive that says impact. These Formula E cars are just too slow, they don't race on proper circuits. No, they still haul, and it does take a great amount of skill and care to drive these vehicles.
Yeah. These cars capable of 170 miles an hour now. They are not slow in any context of motorsport whatsoever.
Yeah. The only reason they appear as slow as they do is because the tracks they're on don't let them hit that kind of speed.
Yeah, they're relatively slow now for the cars that we have. And yeah, it was a terrifying incident. We didn't... And yeah, the broadcast was a bit messy regarding this. We didn't get a replay. Again, for the best...
We didn't get a replay. Yeah, they didn't show a replay. Because they didn't have any footage. Because when Formula E finally released the footage, it wasn't from a TV camera. It was from a CCTV camera. Yeah.
I was going to say, though, like, I read somewhere that, like, as far as, like, the onboards go, like, once you fall out of the top 10, they just shut off your camera. They only have so many cameras to broadcast at the time.
Yeah.
Didn't know that. No, it was a terrifying incident. Again, like, I'm giving the series the benefit of the doubt that they wouldn't have probably just carried on as normal if they'd have known Lynn was in serious trouble. Thankfully, and this is, again, a bit of a... this is something that probably won't get talked about as much, but it probably should. Mitch Evans immediately stopped his car and raced over to check that Lynn was okay. An incredibly noble and human act from Mitch that... straight out of the 80s, like, what you watch, do you watch, yeah. Like, you were back in those days where one accident could still very well be your last. He actually had a chat with Lynn before going in the ambulance. Thankfully, Lynn was completely fine, but again,
yeah, thankfully, it's a crash that looked a whole lot worse than it actually was, and took him to hospital for observation. Ended up being 100% fine. Mm-hmm. As was everyone involved in the various crashes that ended the race. And then in our server member Crisis posted in here that there was a bomb threat at least in the area, if not necessarily directed at the track.
Yeah.
We initially brushed this off only to find out that
we got a little extra zest in the fireworks show.
Yeah, I dug into it, and then it quickly became clear that Riyadh airspace was shut down to civilian traffic, and they were grounding all flights, diverting flights into Riyadh. And I'm like, oh, that's weird. Why is that happening? Next thing you know, there's local news outlets saying, a drone with improvised explosives attached to it was intercepted as it was attempting to approach the circuit. And again, we're talking about, like, in terms of aviation, it was close, but, like, it was at least, like, 10 miles out still.
Yeah, 10, 12 miles was what the reports were saying. Thankfully, of course, nobody affected in the Grand Prix area and whatnot. In fact, if anything, we were getting reports that everybody at Formula E just carried on as normal. You wouldn't have even known, basically. But just quite an eyebrow-raising news report to read in the half an hour or so after the race had finished. We're already all emotionally tense after Alex Lynn's injury. And then thinking, oh, is Lynn okay? And then we just found out that he was okay. And then, like, 20 minutes later, we're getting the report that, oh, there might have been a bomb threat, as you do. It was a tense evening, to say the least. Thankfully, everybody came out of this weekend in one piece, and we had some big ones. So thankfully, everybody was okay. Talking about race two itself, before the red flag came out in the end, a lot of spice. We have to talk about T-Cheetah. That was
we need to talk about this team, because we talked about how good the three German manufacturers looked in race one. Looking like Mercedes was gonna do their usual thing of walking right in and resting their nuts on the table.
Then they DS to Cheetah.
DS to Cheetah is still running last year's car, and by all accounts, were it not for the clash between their two teammates, could have very easily won this race 1-2.
Yeah.
It feels weird to think that, like, you know, here these teammates have a clash, and, like, of, like, the three weirdest things that happened this weekend, it doesn't even get on the... It doesn't even factor in for consideration, although that's like, another one of those...
Yeah, like, that's why I said, like, in terms of Neo and Dragon being competitive, like, they really aren't, because both Tachitas just blew past them like they weren't even there.
Yeah. When it mattered, they blew past them quite easily. Look, they're in Group 4 for Race 2. This wasn't the most straightforward track to pass, and there was, like, one overtaking opportunity on the circuit, really, and that was down the lengthy back straight. They did very well to hold on as long as they did, and via the demotions and time penalties, ended up with pretty good results. I think Turvey scored points in both races.
Oliver Turvey has more points in this weekend than he did in the last two seasons.
Yep,
exactly.
That's awesome. Neo. I don't care how he got there.
This is the best Neo has ever looked.
Like their performance. Their performance on Saturday was awesome. You can't deny that. But in terms of the long-term prospects of this team, this is not going to happen every Saturday.
No,
but it's just, it's great that it happened at all, even if it was just for one weekend. And look, hey, there was potential for Nico Mueller to double up his points because he got demoted out of race one Super Pole.
Yep.
Same with Tom Blomqvist.
Sergio Sete Câmara was
plugging away in there really well in the top five for pretty much the entirety of the flag race.
He was doing some great stuff wheel to wheel. He certainly has it behind the wheel. I'm just thinking right now, like, this and the next race is like they're the opportunity to run away while Diaz Tachita gets their new powertrain ready. Mm-hmm. And that was not achieved.
No.
And
you need as big a lead as you can get when you're dealing with these guys.
Even if we almost had, like, you know what it is? It's like a pro wrestling storyline where they almost tease the big heel turn, and it's not quite happened yet. It's like we're maybe one incident away, because we were close in race two.
We were a couple of inches away from total and complete disaster.
Yeah, it was a big PR job from Vernon DaCosta after that race. Like, Vern was like, we've got to talk like gentlemen in the back.
DaCosta was like, look, I always put my hands up when I'm responsible for an injury. No, you don't.
It's like,
they're
getting chirpy now. And then Vern had to be all diplomatic. Vern was like, no, we're going to go into the back. We're going to talk this over. We're going to talk about the leadership of the team going forward, which is already kind of biased given that Vern owns half of it.
Though, admittedly, it was DaCosta who almost sent both Vern and himself into a tech pro barrier.
Right, he's right. Yeah. It was DaCosta that was by far the greater aggressor in all of this. And DaCosta's pretty much always been that guy. Like, you know, he's always gone the extra mile for those sorts of incidents. We seen it, to quote Twitter. So I'm actually amazed that Vern hasn't either he hasn't clocked and he's totally naive, or he has clocked and he's being as diplomatic as possible.
But because
we are like this close to an implosion.
I'm surprised that like more people didn't see this coming. I was surprised when people mentioned us on Twitter saying, "Oh, you guys called it." I'm like, did no one else see this?
This was
happening?
So easy.
It's like not calling Hamilton versus Rosberg in Spa. It was gonna happen.
Hang on, this is the level of difficulty in this prediction. I'm going to drop my phone and it's going to land on the ground. Oh my god, what a surprise, it landed on the ground.
We saw this all, look, Tempelhof Knights, to throw it back to then, we saw plenty of evidence then that the relationship between these two is not as friendly as it could be.
It's and prosperous, like, but as it's they not continue- friendly.
It's like, well, you know what it is? I think they like
same as the Mercedes-Benz partnership from 2014 to 2016. They started off friendly, And as both of them fight for titles, they are getting increasingly punchy with each other.
Are they going to blame one or the other for splitting the Formula E group dinner check 18 ways?
Yes.
Of course. I'm just saying, did anybody actually believe it at the end of Berlin last season when Verne was like, come here, old pal, and then jump up arm in arm? I was like, this is bullshit. I don't believe this for a second. They are going to be at each other's necks by the middle of next season. And if there was a night four of Temple of Nights, I was sick next and I couldn't season. Make it that night. If I was in that final episode of Temple of Nights, I would have absolutely said on the record, these two are going to kill each other by the end of season four. If it was the Mercedes part, it'd be like the season seven, I should say, of this sport. Like, you can't put two big powerhouse, big ego personalities like the Costa and Verne in the same team.
These two have... We saw it from Verne back when he was in Formula One with Toro Rosso. He was many things. Quiet for a personality was not one of them.
No, he's always been a bit of a shit talker, and Da Costa has always been a bit of a hothead. This was always going to happen, and again, it's not quite full implosion yet. We're nearly there. No, the band is like an eight.
It's a powder keg, and the building is on fire, and it's in the one room that's not on fire.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like
that door can't hold forever.
Though I think we need to mention kind of the biggest deciding factor on who scored and didn't score points in race two, the second attack mode. Well,
yeah,
it heavily affected one Jean-Eric Verne, who got his podium stripped.
Yeah, yep, Verne finished third on the road. I went back and did the digging on this because I was writing a script for a video about it. I rewatched it. There was 11 minutes to go when the full course yellow came out. Now, the rules are now, a new rule for this season, you cannot activate an attack mode under a full course yellow or a safety car.
Yeah.
That is obviously for obvious reasons. You're having cars overtake you behind a safety car. That's silly and it shouldn't be happening.
You can't get overtaken behind the safety car. So people, in theory...
You can take your attack mode with no track position.
Yeah, with no track position loss.
Right. Sorry. I could fuck a few spots back there. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're basically removing the risk of using an attack mode under green flag conditions. So obviously the tactical advantage of taking an attack mode under a safety car is obvious. So that rule was scrapped. There's also another minor caveat. I mean, that means you've now got to leave 4 minutes between both attack modes being used on track during a green flag. So again, they've changed the rule book to stop people taking advantage of said rule. The full course yellow came out of 11 minutes to go in the race. Now, the race ultimately would end as it was under that full course yellow, then the safety car, then the red flag came out of about 4 minutes left. We knew it wasn't going to be restarted. They called the result right there in Engels because of the barrier damage that happened to Lynn's car. 18 of the drivers in the race had taken both attack modes before that safety car came out. But yet, people were mad as hell that Verne lost that podium online. People were blowing up on this.
Because
I was just mad that those three, Blomqvist and Cassidy and Miller got dropped out of Super Pole when they could have red flagged instead of ending that session under a local yellow.
Yeah, because with the attack mode, everyone knew what the optimum strategy was, where you just evenly distribute it across the race. It's a 45-minute race. You have to do attack mode twice, so you take it at the 15-and-a-half-hour mark. And Verne played with fire, and he lost.
Yeah, you leave a certain level of risk leaving your second attack mode, or either of your attack modes, that late into the race, where if the yellow comes out, you might be SOL.
Because, in theory, the same exact thing can happen in Formula One if, say, you don't use the second tire compound and you're literally waiting for the last portion of the race and there's a safety car period or a red flag that ends the race and you're going to get a penalty for that.
Yeah.
The later you leave it, the bigger the risk you run of getting caught short. And Verne was basically caught with his pants down. It's as simple as that. And if the race had ended under red with maybe 20-25 minutes left on the clock, I'd sit here and say, yeah, maybe some common sense mitigation would come into play here, because half the race didn't run.
Yeah, I believe it does fall. I think the rule does fall under force majeure, where, depending on how late it is left, it's up to the decision of the stewards whether they decide that, okay, you weren't allowed to because of mitigating circumstances, or right. you were taking a risk.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, if that was 20 minutes or 25 minutes left in that race and they can't restart it, and like maybe half the field hadn't taken an attack mode, I'd be sitting there saying, yeah, let's go for the common sense solution here and let's just call it a wash under this one, right? But this was with 11 minutes to go, there was still a quarter of the race left, and you in the context of the race, pretty much everybody that was still running in that Grand Prix had taken their second attack mode by then.
Yeah.
Like, I think the only guys that hadn't was, like, Blomqvist, Rast, and I think, obviously, Verne himself.
Yeah, and it was fairly certain that if Verne had taken the attack mode at any point just before the yellow had come out, he would have lost his position to DaCosta.
And the funny thing is, as well, is that Verne pretty much admitted it after the race, even though he was on the podium and took his champagne.
Yeah, he
solemnly in the back of his head, he pretty much had admitted he was probably going to lose that podium. And he did.
Yeah.
You know, so he knew he was taking a chance. He knew he ran the risk of getting caught short under a late yellow. And that's exactly what happened. And yeah. I say tough shit, basically, on this one.
It's one of those things. You take that risk, you run the possibility of running afoul of the rule, indeed. And hopefully he doesn't fall afoul of it next time, because then he looks doubly stupid.
But, you know, indeed. There's a long way before we actually have to worry about when to take attack modes, isn't there?
Yeah. You'd think. Yeah, like we thought we had to address that at some point as well, because that was a big talking point coming off the end of the weekend. And, I know people that were absolutely pearl clutching.
Yeah, and there are
slam dunk 24-second penalty.
And there are other penalties given for what happened near the end of the race, like rookie Nick Cassidy got penalized for speeding under full course yellow.
He was running sick. I was like, oh.
Yeah, that.
Damn it, Cassidy.
Spoiled what was on his own merits. Yeah, a fantastic first weekend. Look, we know Nick Cassidy is box office. RJ and I have been telling you that for years. Damn it. Listen, the man's excellent. Pascal Wehrlein shoulder charged someone into the wall, got a penalty for it. Ended up getting points regardless.
It was Jake Dennis, I think it was. Yeah,
Dennis forced him off at turn. Yeah, he forced Wehrlein off at turn one, I believe. So Pascal decided, well, if you're going to be that aggressive, I'm going to be this aggressive.
You hit him with a Burnout Paradise T-bone takedown into the wall. I mean, there's no other word for it. I mean, we literally joked during the Discord, it was like JBL's clothesline from hell. It was an awful shot to the wall.
I hate it, Michael.
Oh my god.
It was awful, but yeah, again, sorry, penalty given for that as well. And again, as we mentioned, I think Wehrlein still ended up with points, didn't he?
He did, due to all the post-race penalties.
Of course.
De Vries leads the championship 32 points, 0-25 over Sam Bird. Robin Thrin's third on 22. Edo Martara, despite not starting the second race, still has 18 points. He's fourth. And Antonio Viscoso and Mitch Evans are tied at 15 apiece. And we'll have a long time to think about all of this because the Nets Grand Prix in Rome is scheduled for the 10th of April.
I'm just thinking how every constructor has now scored points except for BMW, as God intended.
With your flat logo that doesn't look good on anything but a car that's all black.
Heated seat subscription, have an ass.
What, heated what, seats what, is a service.
I'm going to go out on a limb here. Zoe
straight up not having a good time.
Many people in this Discord server we record this show in, like, there's a lot of hate for BMW in here. Not that I blame them. but let's just say they're not popular in these parts.
It's more the BMW part.
Look, I wake up every morning in a cold sweat seeing the number 25 BMW just burn out. Take down the number 79 Porsche off the fucking start at Daytona.
Right. It says it all when friend of the show, Zoe Hamilton, just puts in the chat, quote, Paindretti, which is hilarious to me.
Oh, you think this is pain? Just imagine the IndyCar season coming up.
More on that in April. I think that'll just about do it for this week's show.
We didn't run down the rest of the top 10.
Oh, sorry, my bad. Yeah, Kadri, carry on, please. Yep. By all means.
Roland is 7th on 14 points. René Rast, 8th on 13. Sergio Sette Camera, 12 points, and he's in 9th. And Pasco Wehrlein with 11 points rounds out the top 10.
Yeah, and as I said, the team titles, 11 of the 12 teams have already scored points. We're two rounds in. Formula E, everybody. Never a dull moment. And this was a hectic weekend, to say the least. They'll be back in the middle of April for Rome. Fingers crossed, of course. That'll just about do it for this week's episode. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time to talk for our Formula One season preview, because by that point, testing would have already happened. And we'll get into the car launches or delivery talks, all the inevitable bold predictions we'll end up coming out with by accident, and trying to figure out a fancy way of stretching out a way of saying Lewis Hamilton will win his 8th world title over the course of probably an hour and change. Good luck to us on that one, because that's going to be a challenge, but if anybody can do it, it's us, the guys that used to have 3-hour shows for fun. So I feel like taking that one on.
I'll be enjoying sitting in my corner of the church, slowly writing out my sabering 12-hour preview.
Well, the monolith has already written a piece about Botas 4.0. I'm not going to hear any of this
Botas.
I'm not hearing any of this Botas NT Workstation 4.0 bullshit.
Fuck that. No one is here for this. We are not doing this again. And I don't even blame Valtteri, because you know what? The man has to say something to make it look like he's a title challenger this year. Because he's not going to turn around and say, no, I'm just here to win a couple of rounds, make qualifying a bit spicy,
for the season preview.
I'll save the rest for 2 weeks' time.
We can always call an audible and preview MotoGP instead.
No! We have to get this out of the way now.
I can sum up MotoGP in one sentence. But I'm not gonna. We're waiting for the preview.
Well, it'll be fun. It'll be season preview season, Formula One in 2 weeks' time, MotoGP in 3 weeks' time, and then IndyCar the week after that. It's going to be a season preview season, we like to call it here on Motorsport 101. A lot of previews, a lot of seasons. It's going to be fun. Thanks for King for stopping me from giving away the hot sauce 2 weeks early on a Valtteri Bottas preseason rant, which for me isn't even his fault. But we'll get into that in 2 weeks' time. A place you can find us one more time, you're on youtube.com/motorsport101, or on facebook.com/motorsport101, or on Twitter at motorsport_101, handles on the screen down below, at Harrison101HD, at RJ O'Connell, at Ryan Eric King, at CBuckley917, on Instagram as well, motorsport101pod, you can check us out on there as well, and Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our audio shows. You can upgrade to $10 for the video versions and access to the supporters club of our Discord, where you can listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded. Big thanks to my co-host as always. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time to preview the 2021 Lewis Hamilton beatdown. Until then, I've been Andre Harrison, they've been RJ O'Connell, Ryan Eric King, and Cam Buckley. And until next time, thanks for listening. Sayonara.
And remember to have some water.
Yes.
You have to have water if you want to be the champion.
Yes, you do. Bye.
I'll manage without.
I'm getting the absinthe.
I'm getting the Everclear.
Clorox.
my favorite.